It's 7:30. Time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Donald MacLeod.
Thank you very much. Well, tonight, before your very ears, an evening of magic, fantasies, dreams and even nightmares, conjured with all their characteristic energy and gusto by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, making their annual visit to the BBC Proms. Each year, they have the treat of working with one of the world's great conductors, and this year's no exception. Semyon Bychkov will be coming onto the podium shortly to conduct these young players in three dazzling pieces of orchestration. The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas and his fellow countryman Hector Berlioz's hallucinatory Symphonie Fantastique. In between, the London premiere of a work by the British composer Julian Anderson called Fantasias, which offers the orchestra the chance to show what it can do section by section. Well, later on, I'll be talking to a couple of members of the NYO. Well, not so long ago, for yet another generation of children, the music of Paul Dukas's most famous score became pretty well inseparable from the image of Mickey Mouse in his bright blue magician's hat, desperately trying to get control of an army of broomsticks carrying pails of water, when Walt Disney's 1940 film Fantasia was reissued in a souped-up new version, 60 years after it was first seen. But behind the cleverness and the humour and the superlatively animated full-length film, the first of its kind, with great music magnificently recorded as never before, there's a brilliant piece of orchestration by Dukas. The orchestra already in place on the platform. The leader of the NYO for this first half of their programme is Rose Hinton. And now here comes Semyon Bychkov to begin their programme with those wonderful, mysterious string harmonies that tell us something strange is about to happen in The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas.
Thank you.
A final clip round the ear from his master for the unfortunate apprentice magician in that musical account of the spell that goes famously wrong. Semyon Bychkov conducted the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain in the opening work of their programme at the 2010 Proms. The Sorcerer's Apprentice by Paul Dukas, inspired by a ballad by Goethe, and making a fizzing opening to their prom. Well, the work was a massive success for Dukas after its premiere in 1897. It really took off, and I think he ended up feeling rather like the hapless apprentice with no way of stopping the piece. That's music which is almost too familiar from its association with the film Fantasia for us to be able to hear it afresh. Well, next, the National Youth Orchestra are going to play a piece you've almost certainly not heard before. Fantasia's by Julian Anderson, a composer in his early 40s. This is its London premiere. Bold orchestration is a hallmark of his work, and this 25-minute piece in five movements magnificently tests the mettle of these young players, giving each section of the orchestra a chance to shine. Julian Anderson wrote it originally for the Cleveland Orchestra, one of the world's great virtuoso ensembles. I asked him what the challenges were in these pieces that the NYO players are taking on.
They are demanding of the players, but in different ways. For example, the slow movement, if it is slow, which is the third Fantasia, anyone who's playing a slow note in the strings, for example, they have to change the placing of the bow on the strings and the pressure of the bowing, and possibly also the pitch at the same time. It's pretty difficult, actually. And then against that, the winds might be playing more virtuosic kind of music. And then the two interact, and by the end of the movement, they're playing each other's music in a way.
We've just heard some music which is kind of inseparable from cartoon imagery, and I understand that one of the movements has, for you, a cartoon feeling.
Loosely. I was played by a friend about, 15 years ago, a CD of music for Tom and Jerry and Bugs Bunny, by Carl Starling, and when you don't look at the images and you just hear the music soundtrack, you realise just how extreme and compressed the music soundtrack is. And when I was writing the fourth movement, which is the shortest, it's only about 1:45, I found myself thinking of that kind of rate of change and that kind of extremity of characterisation. But I think that's only the starting point. It doesn't, I think, sound at all cartoon-like in the final result, though you certainly, I think, get the idea that things are happening as close together as they can.
Julian Anderson, the composer of Fantasias, the work we're about to hear performed by the NYO. I spoke to a couple of members of the orchestra, Beth Allen, who's 18 and a clarinetist, and Thomas Rowan Young, who's 16 and plays the violin.
The last course we did a whole programme full of verres, and when we got our parts through the post, we looked and thought, oh God, how on earth they expect us to play all this? Then this course we got the Anderson, and literally the page is so black you can't even read it, let alone play it. But it's amazing how quickly it kind of fell together in a way. I mean, the sort of rhythms and ideas that he uses sound out of place anyway, so it was really exciting, and I think my sense of rhythm has improved a lot from playing it. Never be the same.
And what about you, Beth?
Yeah, same sort of things. I mean, in the clarinet section, I'm doubling A clarinet, but second clarinet is doubling detuned B flat clarinet, which means that they have to come on and tune a quarter tone flat, which can sound a bit strange. And the audience, I think, are thinking that we're doing a follow-on from tuning up, which we did last time. And there were very strange instruments, like the spring coil in the percussion section and things like that. So it's getting used to playing with someone who's a quarter tone flat and not trying to tune to them and things like that, which is a bit strange, but it's come together really well, and I'm really enjoying it.
Two of the young players of the NYO. I can see them both in their places on the platform here in what's a pretty well packed Royal Albert Hall. Thomas far over on the right side, one of the first to see Semyon Bychkov come onto the platform when he does. And Beth way over on this side. And here he is now. Semyon Bychkov is going to conduct the NYO in Fantasias by Julian Anderson.
Thank you. Thank you.
the final dizzying rollercoaster ride of the last movement of Fantasias by Julian Anderson. We've just heard it played here, having its London premiere in the Royal Albert Hall, performed by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain, conducted by Semyon Bychkov. What a fascinating, brilliantly coloured series of orchestral panels there were, with some interesting techniques for the young players to master. Delicate thrashing of cellos at one point, the trombonists resting the bells of their instruments on their knees and slapping their hands down on the mouthpiece, some heavy breathing at other points, and the percussion section having a whale of a time, going at it literally hammer and tongs at one point, all eight of them through all five of those pieces. Julian Anderson has joined the NYO on stage, sharing in that applause. He was born in 1967. He studied with John Lambert, Alexander Gurr and Tristan Muraille. His first acknowledged work was Diptych. That was in 1990, an orchestral piece which won him the Royal Philharmonic Society Prize for Young Composers. Here he is, back on the podium, gesturing very modestly to all the players, section by section. He's currently working on an opera project. It's due to be staged at English National Opera in 2014, inspired by the three Theban plays of Sophocles, so Oedipus, the central character. He hinted darkly about some possible casting, but I'm pretty sure I guessed entirely wrong. So far, he's still on Act One, but it's early days. Here he is, applauding the orchestra, indeed, applauding the audience. And that great roar for the brass section of the NYO. And now the percussionists getting their turn. Woodwind standing to attention. And that call for Rose Hinton, the leader. It is a real treat to see this platform packed with so much young talent, 165 young musicians who've obviously been having a very good time, working extremely hard, but having a very good time over these last few weeks. Oh, and here comes Julian Anderson for one last bow. Once again, applauding everybody and gesturing to Semyon Bychkov, who's not joining him, but letting him take that bow by himself. Well, we've heard the NYO in two pieces of really colourful orchestration. After the interval, they'll be taking on one of the great orchestral showpieces, the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. During the interval in tonight's prom, we've another in our series, 20 Minutes, when tonight's enthusiastic young players can hear what life as a professional has in store, as Ian Fisher and some of his fellow musicians take us inside the orchestra.
In these days of reality TV programmes and behind-the-scenes exposés, perhaps even a radio audience has been desensitised enough to hear some of what goes on backstage at orchestral concerts.
Really, Ian?
Well, on your own head be it.
Go on, then.
Certainly, the sight of serried ranks of musicians in evening dress hardly suggests to the casual observer all that takes place off the platform. The concert itself is the tip of the iceberg. Much earlier in the afternoon, the orchestra will have arrived for rehearsal. After clambering off the coach, the first task for the musicians, apart from a lady violinist of my acquaintance who makes a beeline for the shops to stock up on designer labels, is to locate the relevant band room. This is rendered far more difficult than strictly necessary because of the bizarre contest that concert hall architects seem to have with each other to see who can place the orchestra changing rooms farthest from the stage. By contrast, conductors, who have only to carry a small white-painted stick, invariably have their suite a mere few steps from the platform. This cosseting and the fact that they inhabit a world of chauffeur-driven limousines, five-star hotels and subservient lackeys may be the reason actuarial tables show that conductors live far longer than orchestral musicians, a testament to Darwin's little-known secondary theory, survival of the pampered. The rest of us, who have to lug real instruments around, usually find that we are billeted in the bowels of the building, or at its very top. Whichever it is, locating either one will entail a labyrinthine journey. Experienced old hands leave a trail of breadcrumbs or twine, Theseus-like, to assist with finding their way back, while younger and less classically educated colleagues have to rely on the orienteering skills they learn from their Duke of Edinburgh's award. While trekking through the building, it is not uncommon to stumble across dishevelled musicians who have spent years wandering lost through the corridors.
I did get lost in China. Where was that massive hall that we played in Beijing?
Oh, that was the brand new hall in Beijing.
It was like a concert hall and an opera theatre and a ballet theatre or something, all in one building. And it just had to walk miles to get to the changing room. It was a nightmare.
And I got lost around the back, so I decided to walk in through the front door of the hall. And then I had to go through all the x-rays, and I wanted to take all my wallet off me and all the rest of it. And all I was trying to do was get on the stage, and as the concert loomed...
I don't care about the room as long as there's tea.
Once there... And, of course, I can only relate what goes on in the men's band room because the ladies is off-limits to me. I assume it is a perfumed and tastefully furnished haven from the vicissitudes of orchestral life. The next item on the agenda is to stake a claim on a chair. This is not as simple a task as you might think, because A, band room chairs are normally in very short supply. B, four of them will already be occupied by the card school, which has seamlessly decanted itself from the coach and is halfway through yet another hand of bridge. And C, those chairs that remain will all have violin cases on them. Strangely, there always seem to be more cases on chairs than violins in the orchestra, a mysterious phenomenon that falls into the same category as crop circles and the appearance of shopping trolleys in rivers, by which I mean that it is unexplained and nobody witnesses it happen, rather than it's the result of boisterous behaviour by students on the way home from a long evening in the pub.
What's he got against violinists? There seems to be a lot of violin-based comments here.
A major factor in the comfort or otherwise of musicians is the state of the backstage toilet facilities. Churches and cathedrals are generally the worst. I expect those gentle souls who embarked on an ecclesiastical life in days gone by had far more spiritually important issues with which to concern themselves. But it has to be said that toilet provision is normally appalling. Concert halls are generally better provided with conveniences, although even here the situation is rarely ideal. There are a few venues where it is important not to flush the toilet during a performance because it will be heard on stage. Understandably, it is thought that this might adversely affect the mood of the moment, and not only for those in the hall. Even when toilets are of adequate number and well sited, there can still be problems. There is one hall I know where the cubicles are so small that in order for the user to be able to open the door, the builder has had to shave half an inch off the front of the toilet seat. Getting in and out is quite a complicated process, and on more than one occasion I've managed to catch my braces on the coat hook and only struggled free by using a series of manoeuvres the like of which haven't been seen since Houdini was in his prime. In the break between rehearsal and concert, most people go out for tea, but a hardy few remain in the band room to eat their sandwiches or leftovers, the smells mingling to form an interesting amalgam of curry, salad dressing and double bass player.
It can really stink.
I don't like a big meal because it just puts me to sleep at about 7:30, so I don't eat very much.
I drink tea. Lots of tea. I like tea.
Regularly visited venues acquire a very territorial feel. Woe betide anyone who sits in somebody else's seat, assuming there isn't a violin case on it, as these are bequeathed in wills and highly sought after. The band room at this time also takes on the air of a cross between the British Library reading room and a mortuary, but without the unconfined hilarity. Any unnecessary noise or talking is seriously frowned upon, and the only sounds you are likely to hear will be the faint buzz of an MP3 player, the clicking of someone's ill-fitting dentures, or an occasional grunt from the card school. The idea that anyone might consider doing a little pre-concert warming up in these circumstances is quickly dashed. One fixer of semi-professional dates during my student days was renowned for saying, "I don't pay you to practice, lad." Of course, there will probably be no alternative area in which to warm up, so musicians regularly take to the stage for this important activity, thereby giving any early comers in the audience a preview of all the tricky bits that they will hear later in the evening. Things gather pace in the band room as the concert approaches. There is usually at least one person who has forgotten an item of clothing, and it is not uncommon to hear cries of, "Has anybody got any cufflinks they aren't using?" Or, "Can I borrow a bow tie?" Or, "Does someone have a spare pair of gold lame underpants?" And then there is the nudist. There is always one, the person who thinks his body is so perfect that while changing he contrives to stride around the room naked or, which is possibly even worse, clad only in a thong. Of course, his desire to be stripped bare is inversely proportional to the aesthetic quality of his body, and it is very tempting to point out that, though he may feel led to appear as nature intended, it might just be possible that nature has played on him a particularly cruel joke. But soon, even he is clothed, and the band room empties as the musicians prepare to file onto the platform. At this time, there is an unwritten rule that string players should never talk to brass players. This isn't due to some arcane demarcation dispute, but has a far more prosaic reason. It is not unheard of for a piece to require less than the full complement of brass players, whereas string players, as they endlessly tell me, are generally in everything. Realising, when the first chord is heard on stage, that the trombonist who is regaling you with tales of his holiday isn't actually in the overture, although you should be, is not an experience most string players enjoy.
Exactly that has happened to me. I've been in an interval, chatting with a contrabassoon player. Chat, 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 chat. Chat, 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 chat. Oh, by the way, I'm not in this next piece. Oh, shit! And then you just have to run out and just get out of breath. It's not good.
Yeah. It often happens to me. I'm always getting told off for being last on stage.
Yeah, but you should know, because you're in everything all the time.
True. So, maybe I'll learn one day.
Drink slightly less tea.
Less tea and
less
biscuits.
Less tea and biscuits.
After the concert, the band room is transformed as everyone tries to get changed and away as quickly as possible. The banter is rife and the atmosphere no longer resembles that of a morgue, which is ironic given that a rapid and merciless post-mortem on the concert is now taking place. Everything from the conductor's lack of baton technique to the enormous sneeze from the balcony in a tender, silent moment are dissected in the most minute detail. There is even some debate about the invisible miracle of structural engineering that must have been used to underpin the larger-than-life soprano's larger-than-life cleavage.
Some of the singers' outfits do seem to defy gravity.
Some of the singers do.
Gradually, the hubbub dies down as people leave, and it eventually subsides completely when the one person for whom everyone always has to wait is finally ready to quit the building and climb aboard the coach. There is a clearly defined etiquette to orchestral bus travel. The front seats are always reserved for management and those with a tendency to travel sickness. There are no complaints about this arrangement, because if someone is going to throw up on the twisty bits of the journey, you certainly don't want them sitting behind you. Where better to put them than at the front and in close proximity to management? Further back, the middle seats are for the general orchestral members, while beyond the drinking fountain there exists another region of lost souls. Only the brave or foolish venture back there uninvited, and certainly not without a bottle of wine.
If you want a party, you go to the back of the bus. Definitely.
And you don't even think about going to the back of the bus without a corkscrew.
Or a bottle opener.
Or a gig spanner.
What's a gig spanner?
A corkscrew.
Oh, God.
Oh, right. I have a lot to learn.
Once you've been in the orchestra a while and you've come down the back of a bus with a bottle of wine and a corkscrew, and we'll teach you all these things.
You can tell I'm new.
Or boring. Or management.
Or just drink too much tea.
Or just a violinist.
For long journeys, it is important to arrive as early as possible, as seats are booked up by people putting bags and instruments on them. This situation is made worse by the practice of booking seats for friends as well, without realising that those friends have reciprocated by also reserving seats on another coach. The result of this is that everyone else mills around looking for somewhere to sit until just before departure time, when the seat bookers realise their friends aren't coming and so reluctantly move their bags.
Oh, God.
It
must be quite challenging to be a coach driver with a cargo of musicians on board. Most drivers seem to enjoy listening to light music on the radio while travelling. Most orchestral musicians don't. Almost as soon as boarding is complete, the shouting begins. Can we have the radio off, please? Followed shortly by, can we have some heating on? Which narrowly proceeds, it's boiling at the back, any chance of some ventilation? Which raises the whole issue of temperature control. Whatever setting the driver uses, it will never be correct. This demonstrates the strange and unexplained phenomenon of each seat on any given orchestral coach having its own microclimate that is almost the exact opposite of what its occupant wants. As a last resort, you can try to regulate the temperature by fiddling with the little overhead vent thingamies, but this is rarely a success. If it is too cold, it will be impossible to shut off the draft, and opening the vent completely will get you a face full of old leaves, twigs, small birds, and other debris that has been sucked into the ventilation system. Of course, if it's too hot, you might welcome such a blast, even with its unwanted payload. But in these circumstances, all that can be produced is the faintest of breezes that's reminiscent of an asthmatic gerbil. After a concert, musicians are often tired and perhaps slightly more irritable than usual. It is now that the correct stowage of luggage can have a noticeable effect. Large bags generally go in the coach's boot, and bulky instruments are carried on the orchestra truck. But violins are small enough to be taken on board and placed on the overhead luggage rack. There is a knack to this, and here, for the benefit of young violinists, are my three top tips based on years of observation of their more senior colleagues. Firstly, if you have found, or had booked for you, a seat near the front, try to place your case on the rack as near the back of the bus as possible. This means that when you arrive at your destination and drowsiness is making everyone particularly grumpy, you can hold them all up by fighting against the flow of bodies to retrieve your instrument. Secondly, arrange the shoulder strap so that the slightest movement causes it to drop down and annoyingly brush the head of whoever is sitting beneath it. It can take some time for them to realise what this is, as the lights, like the ventilation, won't be working, and visibility will be severely limited in the gloom. Finally, cram as much music as possible into the side pocket of the case and leave the zip open. The manager, you remember, will be sitting at the front and will be using his position to peel crisp £5 notes from a wad of money and pass them to the driver as an incentive to get back to base before an overnight payment will be due to the players. Consequently, as the bus hurtles around corners on two wheels, everything will fall out of the open pocket and land on the person who has already been driven to distraction by the strap torture. With luck, or if the driver is particularly intent on imitating Lewis Hamilton, you may also be able to shower with sheet music people across the aisle, as well as one or two behind.
Well, that's bound to happen if you take the music home, isn't it?
There's nothing wrong with being conscientious.
No, there isn't. You're absolutely right. That's why I play second violin.
Once underway, orchestral coaches invariably travel in convoy. The reason for this is a mystery, but I have a theory that only one driver is ever allowed to know the route at any one time, probably something to do with the obscure practices of the Coach Drivers Guild. Whatever the explanation, the coaches hurtle around as if connected by an invisible thread. If the first one manages to get through traffic lights just as they turn red, the following coaches have to keep up, irrespective of the ensuing carnage, not to mention the highway code. A procession of orchestral buses leaves untold traffic chaos in its wake. One of the few occasions when travelling in convoy can make sense is when there is a mechanical problem. Breakdowns are rare, but when they happen, they can give a timely reminder of one's place in the great scheme of things. Players often have with them not only instruments but also concert gear, so one bus isn't usually big enough to take all the occupants of two. Hence, should your coach happen to grind to a halt, you can expect an announcement by management that section principals should move to the other bus first, and only when they are safely aboard will lesser mortals be allowed to fill up remaining seats, any players left over having to await collection at the side of the road.
Buses never break down on the way to concerts. They only ever break down on the way home.
Yeah, that's true.
Sod's law.
I think we've got nice section principals. They just muck in with everybody
they
else.
They do. Yes.
Everybody's equal.
Half of violin players.
Well, you know, double bass players. Got to have some priorities.
Clarinet players, percussionists.
In Britain, rescue is never far away, but on a tour to East Germany during the dying days of communism, the journey back to our base from a distant concert produced some horrendous knocking sounds. These were eventually identified as being caused by a rapidly failing big end bearing and not, as originally thought, an overzealous percussionist putting in some extra practice. We all managed to somehow squeeze aboard the remaining two buses to continue on our way, but the unfortunate driver of the stricken coach had to stay with his charge over the bank holiday weekend to stop people stealing parts to sell on the black market. Back in Britain, coach drivers have other challenges to contend with, because it is a well-known fact that all musicians can drive perfectly and are therefore quick to complain about the merest hint of jerky clutch control. If the coach happens to be in the care of a relief driver whose usual occupation is to drive lorry loads of sheep carcasses with a consequent disregard for passenger comfort, the moans come thick and fast, along with advice on the best route to take, never the current one.
It's a bit annoying when they don't know where they're going and they don't have any sat-nav and they're trying to do three-point turns in little country lanes.
Round roundabouts in Sheffield more than once.
Yes.
Seem to remember we couldn't find Norwich once.
Is that a bad thing? I've never been, actually. Is it nice?
I think so. We were late, so we didn't see much of it.
Even when trying to be helpful by unloading the bags on arrival, drivers can often find themselves in trouble. In their hurry to empty the boot, it is not unheard of for them to deposit cases on the roadside grass verges, verges that will previously have been visited by members of the local dog population who will have left cunningly concealed deposits of their own, which then become liberally smeared over the luggage. Nice.
Rage.
Nice.
Oh, great.
Disgusting.
And while on the subject of waste products, I would like to make a plea that toilets on coaches should only be used in the direst of emergencies. Some people, for reasons best known to themselves, always find it necessary to save up their noisiest and most antisocial lavatorial activities for the moment the bus sets off. A relief, no doubt, for them, but not good for the rest of us.
Ian, come on.
If you have been fortunate enough to have found a seat that hasn't been booked by anyone else, has a climate that seems to be at the optimum temperature for comfort, and no violin case strapped tickling your ears, you might think you have a reasonable chance of sleeping through the journey. Think again. It's far more likely that your peace will be disturbed by other people's conversations, although it is hard to say which is worse, the disturbance or finding it difficult to hear clearly what is being said. Boring conversations are always distinct. If you want to hear, "My therapist says my problem is that I'm just too giving a dope at a person for my own good," you will likely have no trouble. Conversations that begin, "You'll never guess who's having an affair with," invariably tail off into hushed tones or are drowned out by someone else saying, "My therapist says my problem is that I'm just too giving a dope at a person for my own good." I believe it is now possible to buy sophisticated, directional eavesdropping devices which could help with this. Tempting as they are, I am reluctant to splash out good money on one, only to discover it merely amplifies the sound of a failing big end, noises from the toilet, or someone at the front losing the battle to hold on to their dinner. A musician's life is nothing if not glamorous.
Inside the Orchestra was presented by Ian Fisher and produced in Glasgow by Dominic Jewell. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and the second part of this prom given by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain with the conductor Semyon Bychkov. We're going to hear them in a score which redefined orchestral music, Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. It was the fantastic symphony which really marked Berlioz's coming of age in Paris at the age of only 26. He organised a concert to include the first performance of the symphony just before he left to go and study in Rome. It was a sensational success. Berlioz actually called it an episode in the life of an artist. Symphonie Fantastique was the subtitle. Well, this explicit link between instrumental music and the telling of a narrative marked the birth of a new form of music. At this afternoon's rehearsal, I spoke to two members of the NYO, the clarinetist Beth Allen, who's 18, from Malvern, and who's been here a couple of times before, and Thomas Robin Young, a 16-year-old violinist from Altrincham. It's his first time. This is their third concert this week. They played at Snape Maltings in Suffolk and in Birmingham.
every concert venue for me has been new this year. Just absolutely thrilling, you know, especially Symphony Hall. I was sort of astounded when I walked in at how big it was, and God, am I actually playing here?
And that was big.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to walk out there in a few hours.
Have you been in the hall before?
Not just yet. We've had to rush over from Royal College of Music after doing a composed ensemble rehearsal. So,
wow. I look forward to hearing what you make of that. I think you may be quite impressed.
Yeah.
Beth, you've been through this course before. What was it like working with Bychkov?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's the second time we've worked with him. The first time we played the Alpine Symphony. And it's just amazing. He's a great person to work with for young people as well, because I think he's quite good at relating to us, and he's really good-natured, and he'll laugh in rehearsals and stuff, which just makes everything a lot less stressful. So yeah. It's great to have someone relaxed.
In the Symphony Fantastique, one of the most graphic movements is at the ball, and I understand that you've had ballroom dancing classes. Tell me about that.
We've just had a few workshops, which we often do actually on courses when there's a dance space programme. Mm. It's really good, actually. We get into the style of the dance a bit more, because obviously we don't understand really the dances, which makes it difficult to understand the music.
I don't imagine either of you has done much waltzing.
No, well, we have now, but...
Yeah, I had done a little bit of waltzing before, but... yes, I had.
Oh, really? How
I
did don't, you manage that?
Well, my brother's actually really into ballroom dancing, okay. So got into it through that.
But yeah, it's been a good experience, and
yeah, it really
helps,
fun.
I think.
And this is another life skill you require.
Well, yes.
Definitely.
Very important. And then when you're watching Bychkov, when we're playing it, you can see him sort of doing the same thing, so it kind of helps a little bit.
We kind of join in all this, don't we?
Some people, yeah.
Some people.
Wonderful.
Thomas Rowan Young and Beth Allen, both players in the NYO, just coming onto the platform with their colleagues now to make up their most pumped-up formation tonight, ready to take on the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. I asked Semyon Bychkov how it had been for him working with 165 of the country's most talented young musicians.
These young artists make their country proud. First of all, they're exceptionally gifted musically. They're also gifted intellectually. The fact is they chose to study music, and they chose to devote their whatever spare time they have to practicing the instruments, because to master to play this instrument and play it on the level on which they're doing it requires unbelievable dedication. And the maturity that they have, it's really extraordinary. I look at the age of the orchestra members the other day, I was astonished, ranging between 14 and 19. It's really quite unbelievable. And that they're not only interested, but that they're actually able to come to grips with repertoire as diverse as this program with Dukas and Andersen and the Symphonie Fantastique, which makes the best of the orchestras in the world sit rather tight, because it's really very difficult. It doesn't get any easier as one goes in life. So they are an exceptional bunch of kids.
Tonight's conductor, Semyon Bychkov. Well, the five autobiographical episodes in the life of the artist depicted in the Fantastic Symphony begin with Reveries and Passions, which introduces the haunting theme, the idée fixe, which reappears throughout. In his opium-induced trance, the young artist pictures his beloved at a glittering ball where her appearance interrupts the waltz. Then an idyllic scene in the country is disturbed by her imagined presence. These gentle reveries turn into nightmare in the march to the scaffold, as he imagines being sent to his execution after killing his beloved. Then we hear the spine-chilling Witch's Sabbath. And finally, the round dance and the theme of the Dies Irae combine in an orchestral and rhythmic tour de force. It is, I have to say, a really impressive sight. These rank upon rank of young musicians. The tiers built up right to the back. I mean, where normally there might be the serried ranks of an entire chorus, there's nothing but instrumentalists. The brass section, in pride of place, just below the bust of Sir Henry Wood. Quite interesting to see the slight changes in stereotypical instrumentalism, in that I noticed there's one boy amongst the five harpists, half the French horns are girls, and there's a reasonable representation among the dozen double bassists. I noticed there are two girls. But then when it comes to areas which are perhaps gender-free, not that any of these roles should be gender-specific in any way, I'm not suggesting that, the percussionists are a very evenly mixed bunch indeed. Those roars of cheers greet the leader of the National Youth Orchestra in this second part of their prom, Michael Twaddle, who's worked with the orchestra over some time. And here now is Semyon Bychkov, returning to the platform to conduct the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain in the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz.
Thank you.
The music of a young and exceptionally passionate man played with exceptional passion and verve by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. We heard them in the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz, conducted by Semyon Bychkov, who conducted that performance from memory. The orchestra getting a lot of support from the promenade, as you can hear, some of it quite vocal. I suspect a good deal of it from former members of the orchestra. I think that the big finish in the Royal Albert Hall has become quite a kind of rallying point for members past and present. It really does give one heart for the future of music in these islands, that despite the general dearth of music teaching in schools, we can still produce musicians of this exceptional calibre, capable, as you can hear, of lighting up the Royal Albert Hall. We have to be grateful, we have to celebrate their talent and dedication and determination, and their teachers too, of course. Who knows how many NYO members of this vintage will be able to find jobs as professional musicians. But it's kind of thrilling to think that down there on the platform tonight are, I don't know, perhaps half a dozen young men and women who may join the ranks of the famous names who've passed through this terrific institution. Sir Simon Rattle, Sir Mark Elder, David Pyatt, Anthony Payne, Peter Crocker, Daniel Harding, Judith Weir, and Thomas Addis, to name only a few. Those stamps and cheers for Semyon Bychkov returning to the platform once again at the end of an exceptional evening and pouring out those dazzling soloists we heard. Just listen to that support. Well, tomorrow afternoon, it's Voices that will hold sway here in the Royal Albert Hall. The BBC Symphony Chorus and their director, Stephen Jackson, are joining up with soloists from Trinity College of Music, Chamber Choir and London Brass in what looks like a fascinatingly varied programme. Two pieces by Takemitsu, the world premiere of a BBC commission from Stephen Montague, Daniel Lesueur's Song of Songs, and Francis Poulenc's sensational wartime cantata, Figure Humaine. That's at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. But it's time this evening for me to return you for the rest of Radio 3 Evening to Broadcasting House and Jill Anderson.
Donald, thank you very much. Donald MacLeod there at a very noisy and appreciative Royal Albert Hall. Well, there's another chance to hear tonight's prom again on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And you can also hear it again for the next 7 days on the BBC iPlayer. And that's at bbc.co.uk/radio3. Click on the link at the top of the screen. Well, coming up in a few minutes' time, our play tonight. But first, some music for two pianos, four hands. Fête, one of Debussy's nocturnes, transcribed for two pianos, four hands by Ravel. It was played by duo Lechner-Tiempo, Karin Lechner and her brother Sergio Tiempo. Next on Radio 3, drama in this week's The Wire. We present a second chance to hear Nicola Wilson's dark and powerful exploration of the rich imagery worlds of an old woman and the grandson she never knew she had. The drama cuts between a small terraced house in the summer of 2009 and an Old Bailey courtroom many months later, as we discover what can happen when imagination takes flight. The play contains some strong language. Life on the Edges by Nicola Wilson.
It was raining, I think, the day she came to visit. I remember because the miniature grizzly bear was wearing a white cagoule. I wouldn't open the door straight away because Neighbours was about to start. Miss a bit and you're playing catch-up for weeks if you're not careful.
Mrs. Snowden!
Bright red lips trill through the letterbox. She's from Social Services. And all of a sudden my heart's in my mouth thinking, you know, that someone said something, that she's come to cart me off to the loony bin. And then it strikes me that perhaps the grizzly bear is actually wearing a straight jacket.
Mrs. Snowden, are you there?
Then the lips slippered, she was sorry. About Laura, my daughter. And I remember thinking, who are you with your slippery red lips coming here and telling me you're sorry just when Neighbours is about to start? And where were you lot 20 years ago? Because that's how long she's been dead to me. Then I suppose I must have opened the door, because the next thing I know, she's telling me that I have a 14-year-old grandson called Dino, and that he'd like to come and live with me. First I thought she must have got me mixed up with someone else, some other woman whose daughter called Laura died. And then it occurred to me that maybe the police had got me mixed up too, when they came with their hats in their hands. And I remember wondering if I could get my money back from the florists. I don't know why I thought that. And then there were questions and forms and lists and inventories, and I said what I thought I should say, nodded when I thought I should nod, signed where she wanted me to sign, and tried to ignore the grizzly bear sliding up the walls.
Social drops me off outside the front door. One of them red brick houses will all look the same. One's either side done up nice, but hers is a mess. Yard full of nettles. Crow in a wheelie bin. I knock on the door.
All right?
I open the door to a shadow on the doorstep.
She's wearing a floppy hat and pink sunglasses.
He looks like an upside-down mop.
Lipstick that bleeds out her gob like a spider. She don't look like Mum.
Try tilting my head this way and that. See if I can find her face in his.
Not till her head starts swinging from side to side like her neck's broke.
I don't know what to do, what to say. I offer him my hand.
Her hand's shaking.
We shake hands.
I suppose you better come in, eh? You can call me Ellen or Nan, but not Gran. I'm not old enough for Gran.
She old enough. Believe.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, on 2nd of July 2009, social worker Annabel Farmer identified Dino Snowden, 14 years old, as a child in need. and emergency placement was approved with his maternal grandmother at her home in Acton, subject to statutory checks. He was placed in her care on Monday 6th of July, and an interim assessment was scheduled a week later.
You hungry?
No.
You must be hungry. Annabelle said you liked Monster Munch, but I didn't know what flavour, so I got pickled onion. There's other food in the kitchen, but if it's meat you're after, you'll have to cook it yourself. I don't eat anything that's had bones in it. Or anything green. Gives me indigestion.
The living room's a mess in the middle, tidy round the edges. You can see the lines on the carpet where she's gone out with the hoover. Crumbs in the bit she's missed.
Your room's at the top of the stairs, on the right. It's painted black, I'm afraid. Not much in the way of furniture, but...
She's nervous.
I sneeze when I'm nervous.
I stand in the doorway.
I can feel him watching me. What does he see when he looks at me?
I sit down.
How come you don't got a dog?
His grammar's appalling.
What would I want a dog for?
Well, I don't know. Stop you bumping into stuff. I know a dog will eat Savati. A cheese, isn't it?
Yes, I know what Havarti is.
I don't think I like him.
Just saying, you know, you could get a vegetarian dog if it's the meat thing.
Is he taking the mickey?
Social said you got a problem with your eyes. Are you blind then?
No.
What am I doing there then?
I pretend to have a wank, just for a laugh like.
You ain't even looking.
Unfortunately, I can see you better when I'm not looking at you.
That don't make sense.
Doesn't. You want to know what it's like being me? Try holding your fist out in front of your face and then stay like that forever.
I run around the living room crashing into stuff, and it's funny for a bit, but then it gets boring. Forever is a long time.
It's not that I can't see anything. I just can't see whatever I'm looking at.
So... what you see when you look at me? A black hole?
No.
So what do you see?
Nothing.
You saying I'm nothing?
I'm saying you're not a black hole.
So what you see?
I don't know. You can't see the back of your head, can you? But it's not like you see anything else instead. It just isn't there.
You saying I'm not really here?
No.
Good. I'm sitting right here. So don't go saying I'm not, all right?
She nutty, my gran.
When it first started, I thought I'd just got a smudge in the centre of my specs. Then I noticed words in the newspaper disappearing, lampposts bending. Assumed I needed a new prescription, made an appointment at the optician's. When he told me I had ARMD, I didn't know what it meant. But I could tell from the syrupy tone of his voice that it wasn't good. I remember holding my breath and the world shrinking suddenly as he tried to explain long, uncomfortable-sounding words that I parroted back thickly, my tongue rolling over each syllable like a smashed tooth. And for some reason I thought of a cat. How a cat, when it knows it's going to die, crawls away into the garden to be by itself. Then he gave me a leaflet in small print and a grid to take home, a sheet of paper with squares on and a dot in the middle. I can't remember what he said to do with it, and I didn't know how to fill it in, so I threw it in the bin. I remember the journey home vividly, the smallness of little things. Red and blue diamonds on the bus seats. Raindrops chasing each other down the window. The myriad colours in a brick wall. It astonishes me to this day. The simple beauty of a brick wall. The dignity of a dying cat. Of course, all that was before I started seeing the other things.
GP checks revealed that Mrs. Snowden had been diagnosed with age-related macular degeneration in August 2007. But during her initial assessment, Miss Farmer's report clearly states that Ellen maintained this condition in no way affected her ability to look after her grandson and repeatedly declined offers of community support. Social services were not aware of any other related complications at this time.
We can watch something else now if you like. There's a nature programme on BBC Two. Oh, what's that? What's it got in its mouth?
A polar bear.
No, it's not.
A camel.
Don't be silly.
A yeti.
Yetis don't exist.
Just because you can't see something, don't mean it ain't there.
It's a seal, isn't it?
What's the point in watching telly if you can't even see it proper?
Do seals have bones?
I don't know.
I can see him out of the corner of my eye, picking his nose and wiping a booger on the arm of the sofa. Just like his grandfather.
So, what do you usually do in your school holidays then?
Don't know.
Well, you must do something.
Trek bears, steal horses, fish.
In Wilson Green.
Sometimes I scout people.
Are you being funny, boy?
He thinks he's being funny.
You got a computer?
No.
I need a computer.
What for?
Play Second Life.
What's that? A computer game?
It's not a game. It's a country.
What?
You ever been to the Wild West?
It's an odd question.
I don't fly. Gives you constipation. I like spaghetti westerns, though. Used to watch them all the time with your... when she was little. The Good, the Bad and the Ugly was her favourite. Don't suppose you've seen it.
Bear times. Mum used to put it on when she was off her tits and laugh at bits that wasn't even funny. Only I don't say that.
No, before your time. So, what do you do in this second life? Run round killing things?
No, death don't exist in Linden. You get killed in a role-play sim, you just wait a few hours, res up and start over.
So what's the point of it?
Anything, innit?
Eh?
You get to choose the world you live in.
He starts bouncing up and down on the sofa.
I role-play in Tombstone, Arizona, with Apache Indians. But you can be a giant swivel, or a jellyfish, or a vampire punk. You can teleport to skate parks, tropical rainforests, go skydiving, underwater clubbing, set up a safari park, buy a yak, get married. You can swim in a pool of melted toad barone if you wanna. Anything you want. You just gotta think it.
I look at the grizzly bear slumped on the carpet, scratching his bear bits.
But it isn't real.
What's so class about real? Albert Square ain't real. Real is crackers and Prozac and my mum hanging off the back of a door.
It's late. He's overtired. I send him to bed.
My name is Dr. Norton and I was first instructed by the court to assess the defendant at Feltham Young Offenders Institute on Tuesday the 14th of July 2009. During our first interview, he was aloof and withdrawn and appeared underweight and pale. He understood why he was remanded in custody, but didn't express any other opinion about what had happened. Cognitive testing revealed an IQ of 120.
When I turn off the bedside light, the house feels deathly quiet. Perhaps he's right. Reality bites. No, I was not a good mother.
I lie in the bed listening to the old woman moan. The room is blacker than night, and it feels like I'm falling through space. But I can't sleep because there's a lump in the mattress. And when I put my hand under, I pull out a notebook, fluffy and pink.
A night peels back the years, and I'm back in the ring. 17 years old when she ran away. went off the rails after the death of her father. Always such a daddy's girl. Ding, ding. I suppose I was a little jealous. Yes.
It's got to be my mum's. And it makes me mad, because she's the same age as me when she wrote it. But her world's all music and clothes and boys at school. But the world she gave me is fucked up and loose. And I'm looking for the reason, the secret, the thing. But there ain't no thing. And I hate her just a little bit more.
Underdressing, overspending, grades sliding, bones grinding. I was careless. Careless.
Couldn't care less. Rip the pages into tiny little pieces. Stuff them in my mouth.
Older men, long sleeves, piss off and die, mum. Oh.
Swallow.
The bile.
And when I fall asleep, I dream of snow-capped mountains in Tombstone, Arizona. Of war-painted faces, howling coyotes, rivers of blood. There's an earthquake and a tornado whips off my head. And as I look down through the spiral of a cloud, I see a crow lay an egg in the hole where my head were. And when the egg hatches, my mum crawls out, covered in straw. When I wake up, I've wet the bed.
Fast forward and I'm in my rollers putting my face on. The disembodied head of Ian Beale is floating in the bath, so I put off showering and feel my way downstairs. The miniature grizzly bear is hiding in the teapot again, so I drop a tea bag on his head and pour boiling water all over him, all over my hand. My hand is burning, and the pain takes the pain away.
I hide my wet pyjamas in the wardrobe.
Half past nine and still no sign of the mop boy. Tick-tock, tick-tock. I decide to take breakfast up to him.
I'm hiding my wet pyjamas in the wardrobe when I clock a stripe of turquoise feathers wriggling behind a long black coat.
I decide to boil an egg.
And out wriggles my very own Apache shaman, twirling his moustache, smoking a cigar, wearing cowboy boots, a tasseled skirt and a giant turquoise headdress.
Mexican Bob, where have you been, you swine? The sheriff, he nailed my wanted poster to every tree in Broken Rose after I steal his horse. And then, Brother Black Bear found me in Dutch Annie's and stuck a cactus up my culo to avenge Sister Mountain Flowers. How you say, de-flowering. She now just Sister Mountain.
But I'm not online.
I can see that, you chicken-livered skunk. Que pasa?
Stuff.
He who abandoned me in the middle of the fight, he understand nothing about Mexican Bob, you son of a yellow-bellied pig!
My mum died.
You kill her?
No.
So I have aunt who plays the guitar. Olvida tu madre.
Coming, ready or not? Slowly, slowly, I negotiate the stairs, bearing my perfectly boiled egg, and when I get to the top, I stop to catch my breath and ignore the Victorian chimney sweep sliding up and down the banisters.
Do you know?
It's my gran. You go ahead.
Oh, no, Mexican Bob, no hide from Viejecita.
Get back in the wardrobe.
Oh, no! Oh. Oh.
I'm pooping your milk, Gino.
Gino, who are you talking to?
No one.
It is I, Mexican Bob, son of Mexican Sheila.
The plate rattles ominously in its tray.
Her hands are shaking.
Senora, I know you codfish even though you wear a disguise, but if this snake bites you, there is no remedy in the pharmacy.
I brought you some breakfast.
Poison!
You need to eat, day like today.
Mexican Bob is leaping up and down Muay Thai style, but she don't see nothing.
He takes the tray from me.
Poison!
He snatches the egg and swallows it all.
I think he eats it.
And then he's thrashing around on the floor, foaming at the mouth, feathers from his headdress flying everywhere. I know he's faking it, because avatars don't die. So when Gran closes the door, I sit and wait for him to stop wiping. Only when he's still, he looks so still, his eyes so far away. I have to go and double check, and as I bend over him, he flips back up like a ninja.
Ha ha! I trick you! Let this learn you, amigo. Without me, it is you who are bad egg. You and me. We all alone in the world. Only Mexican Bob rid you of the scarecrow in your brains.
And then he disappears.
During our second interview, the defendant experienced a psychotic episode and mistook me for an online avatar of his own creation. This delusion, and others like it, persisted intermittently for several months. At this point, I transferred the defendant to the healthcare wing.